music and talk radio about all things all genders. This is Intravenous, live on CJSF 90.1 FM, discussing and approaching contemporary gender issues through a feminist lens. Our goal is to educate, engage, and challenge the dominant hegemony.
Happy Wednesday, and welcome to Intravenous here on campus and community radio, CJSF 90.1 FM. I'm Robin, and just here really to introduce the show for today. We've had the privilege of broadcasting some of the panel discussion that was put together by SFU Public Square. The panel happened last week and was called Mobilizing Fear and Information, Anti-SOGI and Parents' Rights Movements. And for anyone who doesn't know what SOGI is, it refers to sexual orientation and gender identity. And the panel discussion that we'll hear is in response to some of the backlash that's happening out there in the community in terms of how sexual orientation and gender identity is being affecting kids in our community. And so we're going to hear that that panel outside of a few question and answers at the very end, but in its entirety today.
Welcome to Mobilizing Fear and Misinformation, Anti-SOGI and Parents' Rights Movements. I'd like to begin with recognizing the unceded territories, including the Squamish, Tsleil-Waututh, and Coquitlam, and Musqueam nations on which the city of Vancouver is located. Rather than having an Indigenous elder come and open the ceremony, we have chosen to make a donation to Niskanaw Foundation. And in the chat, you'll find pay your rent as an option to acknowledge that we are uninvited guests on these territories. My name is Travers. I'm a sociology professor at Simon Fraser University. I am responsible for organizing this event. There's no way that you cannot have been aware of all the anti-trans campaigns that are happening, and there was the 1 million voices for children. One of the things that is so alarming is that ordinary people are being exposed to lies and misinformation, the purpose of which is to generate fear and push trans and queer people back out of public life. I'm in the process of interviewing trans youth, and one of the things that I find myself saying to them when they talk about how difficult the current political climate is for them personally, I take a little moment to be a trans elder and say, well, just so you know, I was born in 1962. I never in my wildest dreams ever expected to have the quality of life and inclusion that I experience. I never believed it would happen. We have done incredible things. The queer and trans people before me and those who have continued to organize, in a 50-year period, we have radically changed the way in which queer and trans people are viewed and treated in society. And we need to understand what's happening, this current backlash, as a response to our success. And that is really important, to understand that what is happening, anti-trans campaigns, anti-SOGI campaigns, conservative politicians, they are trying to push us back out of public life. And that is where we will not go. We are going to have some setbacks. We're not going to win things. Sometimes these measures are going to be passed. But we have to have the faith that we've accomplished so much already under way worse circumstances, so we're going to do it again. And the purpose of this panel is literally to give people an opportunity to find out what the lies that they're being told, where misinformation is, and be in a room, either online or in person, where you can ask questions and we can have a discussion. That is our purpose. We're going to hear some remarks from our openers, the moderator, and then panelists, and there will be a Q&A session after the panelist discussion. There are a few community guidelines that I will ask all of us to respect so that we can have a safe, honest, socially accountable dialogue together. Above all, there will be zero tolerance for those who promote violence or discrimination against others. Anyone who incites harm towards other participants will be removed at the discretion of our technical team and moderator. We also ask that you don't assume pronouns, gender, or knowledge based on someone's name or appearance. Please refer to people using the pronouns they provide, and don't be afraid of making a mistake. Either you'll be corrected or you'll correct yourself and we keep going. And we ask you finally to approach this event with an open mind and an open heart. Be curious. And now I'd like to introduce Scout, the Director of National Programs at the ARC Foundation, who will be sharing a few words. Scout is an education and youth engagement specialist with over a decade of progressive leadership experience in the nonprofit sector. They support SOGI inclusive education through collaboration and empathy and have a deep commitment to creating inclusive spaces for all. They have worked with education leaders across Canada to share, workshop, and refine best practices in supporting 2SLGBTQ+ students, staff, and families. Scout is responsible for leading SOGI 123 programs nationally for the ARC Foundation.
Thank you, Travis, and thank you for having me at this event and for giving the opportunity for us to speak a little bit. As you heard, I work with SOGI 123, and we know that SOGI Inclusive Education and SOGI 123, the program that we run and the ways we support educators are different, but they often get really collapsed into the same thing. So I'm going to talk a little bit about what we do as an organization. SOGI 123 supports educators. Right now we're working in BC, the Yukon, the Prairies, and Atlantic Canada. And we work directly with school staff, with directors, superintendents, EAs, anyone within the schools that are trying to create those safe and inclusive environments for their students. So we try to provide that direct support to staff so that they can better support their kids. We know that so many educators are really dedicated to doing this work. I know there's so many people who have joined today to figure out how to do this well, especially in this time of increased hate and increased misinformation and a lot of lies about what is actually happening in schools. We know that students thrive when parents and school staff, teachers work together, and that the best opportunities and the best outcomes for youth are when the parents are engaged. And we really want to welcome parents in, and so really appreciate this event focusing on that and really making sure that students are supported by staff and families alike. We are so grateful to have been asked to join and to speak a little bit about SOGI 123, where we know that this rise in hate is making it more difficult. Again, we've made a lot of progress, but there's a real increase in fear amongst educators. So for the educators, know that you can access us, our resources, everything we have online is free and available, and you can reach out and we can support you in navigating this as well. Thank you so much.
Scout, thank you so much. We have some brilliant panelists that I will be sitting in conversation with today. I'm going to briefly introduce them here and give them the chance to speak more about their research in a few minutes. We have Dr. J. Wallace Skelton, who is an assistant professor of queer studies and education at the University of Regina. Jay is interested in research with children as co-researchers and in using comics to make academia more accessible. Dr. Victoria Thomas is an assistant professor of media and public engagement in the School of Communication at SFU. As an interdisciplinary scholar of Black popular cultural studies, she primarily analyzes popular media to articulate how visual culture represents Blackness and Black identities. Her research is committed to political and civic engagement, diversity, and inclusion in public institutions to transform societal conditions. And now I'd like to introduce the moderator for today's discussion. We're so lucky to have Michelle Elliott with us here today. Michelle is an award-winning journalist and the host of CBC, British Columbia's weekday call-in show, BC Today, where she engages in conversation with listeners on the day's top stories and on issues important to British Columbians. Michelle has hosted numerous CBC News specials, including election and provincial budget coverage on both local and network programs. She has also tapped into her Filipina heritage as part of CBC's Mabuhay BC, an ongoing initiative to share stories from the province's Filipino community. Born in the Philippines, Michelle moved to Canada at 12 years old, settling in North Vancouver. Her experience as a young immigrant inspired a yearning to tell the stories of people whose lives are changed by new circumstances. Thank you again, Michelle, and over to you.
Thank you very much, Travers. It's my pleasure to be here with you. And we're going to get into a discussion a little bit later on. We'll have a Q&A just amongst ourselves here with our panelists. And as well, we'll take some questions from our audience both here and online. Right now, let's hear a little bit more from our panel members and find out more about their perspectives and their research and how that informs what they bring to our discussion here today. And let's start with Dr. Victoria Thomas.
Hi, everyone. My pronouns are she and her. As mentioned before by Travis, I am an assistant professor in the School of Communication. A lot of my research looks at media representations of Black trans identities and non-binary identities. I also do some research and lots of interviews and focus groups with Black trans women in Surrey. So a lot of my research focuses on thinking about the intersections of Blackness and transness and ways in which we can be better community members, in particular Black community members, to our queer and trans sisters and brothers. So currently working on a project looking at hate speech as it coincides with the U.S. election around LGBTQ people, individuals, as well as working on my first manuscript, which looks at a decade of trans inclusion in television, starting with Laverne Cox in 2013 and kind of leading us up into this particular area, which I know we're moving into an anti-diversity area. So we're seeing a lot of television shows move away from these diverse representations. So my research focuses in that. And so a lot of the things I bring to this is thinking about the ways in which the media is pushing a lot of misinformation and the ways in which we can fight back against that misinformation.
Thank you so much. And now let's move down the line here and introduce Dr. J. Wallace Skelton.
Thank you. So I want to say, Travers in the introduction said that I'm interested in co-research with children as well as trans and non-binary children. And I want to say that both of these for me are about children's agency. And how do we as a culture recognize children as fully human, as knowledge makers, as whole people with things to teach us and share with us, and who need to be able to make choices about their own lives? And so that's a really present theme in a lot of the work that I do. I am working on two projects at the moment, one of which has been interviewing parents who see themselves as advocates for their two-spirit trans and non-binary young people. Thinking about how do we resource parents, how do we support parents, how do we share their success stories. It's been a really interesting moment to do this in a conversation where parents' rights have suddenly been weaponized against trans and non-binary and two-spirit youth. And to say we've done interviews with 70 parents across Canada whose rights are not being respected as parents and who see their rights as parents as secondary to their children's rights. And how do we ensure that children's rights are being respected because they're real and present and there and not a language of parental rights? My other piece of ongoing research is thinking about ways that this current language of parents' rights and attacks on education around sex and gender and sexuality in school is impacting people and ways we are resisting and creating possibilities nonetheless. That second part being really important to me because we are doing brilliant things in difficult places. And we are creating possibilities we didn't know that we'd have to build, but that are nevertheless delicious and brilliant and necessary. And I want to make sure that we don't lose those in a space that feels toxic and hard.
Thank you very much. And Travers, if you would like to share more, I know you started this event and organized it. You know, what prompted you to do that? And what would you like to come out of this conversation tonight?
I published a book on trans kids in 2018 called The Trans Generation, How Trans Kids and Their Parents Are Creating a Gender Revolution. And it was based on interviews with over 30 trans kids and young people, as well as additional interviews of parents of trans kids. And it came out in 2018, but I basically finished writing it right after Trump had been elected. And I certainly noted the damaging change in tone with that administration compared with the Obama administration with regard to queer and trans people. But I didn't expect this to happen, that we would see Alberta pass the policy that it did, that we would see New Brunswick pass the policy that it did, that we'd see Saskatchewan pass the policy that they did, and then announced that they would be invoking the notwithstanding clause so that they could basically ignore the human rights of their student population. I didn't expect the anti-queer and anti-trans backlash to be so intense. You know, perhaps that was my own naivete, but we definitely have people who have trouble with trans people and don't want us to exist. Absolutely. There are people who believe that, you know, there are only two sexes and the lines demarcating one from the other are absolutely clear, which they're not. But in any event, the popular wisdom is there. But what I noticed with the most alarm is that conservative politicians and organizations are using fear-mongering, particularly around trans kids, as well as the participation of trans women and girls in women's sport, in order to gain political office and pass a whole series of measures that increase social inequality more broadly and are incredibly harmful for public institutions. So I think it's really important to note that not only are we seeing trans people being targeted for you know, discrimination, etc., but we are seeing conservative movements using trans politics, anti-trans politics, to seize state power. So I think it's really important that we understand this. And the round of interviews that I've been doing with trans kids and young people now in these times is very different. There's not the sense of hopefulness. There's not the sense of things are getting better, because that's not what's happening. I'm talking to kids who had access to trans-affirming healthcare, and now they don't. And some are able to move from state to state to flee these measures. And in Canada, I'm sure some people who can afford to are considering leaving Alberta in the hope that a province that they move to won't adopt similar measures. So it's really been on my mind, and I've been wanting to just create more space so that we could have conversations to understand what is misinformation versus what is fact.
Thank you very much. And we're going to go into a little bit of a conversation now with our panel members here. And Travers, I'm struck by what you just said, that the interviews you conducted a few years ago for your book, very different from the interviews you're conducting now. And you touched on the legislative changes that we've seen here in Canada, in Saskatchewan, New Brunswick, and last week in Alberta. And perhaps let's focus on that, the mandate that students under the age of 16 need parental consent to change their name or use their preferred pronouns in school. What happens when these policies are put in place? What is the impact on queer and trans youth and all students? And perhaps we'll start with you, but we'll have our other panelists, Jay and Victoria, join in as well.
I think what people don't understand is that often queer and trans kids find school to be a safer place than home. And in school, they can have their pronouns respected. They can have a name that they feel more appropriately represents them used. And they may or may not be prepared to share this information with their parents. And I guarantee that one of the first questions a school staff member or a teacher would ask, have you spoken with your parents about this? And if the kid says, no, I haven't, you know, they'll say, is there a way that I can help you have this conversation? Teachers are not trying to keep information from parents. They're trying to keep children safe. And if a child in your care tells you, If my parents learn that I am queer or trans or non-binary, I don't know what will happen, but I'm terrified. You have a duty to protect that child's well-being. The measures that are passed in New Brunswick, in Alberta, in Saskatchewan, now require school staff to report to parents if a child in their care discloses a queer or trans identity. They require parental permission to use the appropriate pronouns, the appropriate name for the child. And the Alberta policy took it one step further in that New Brunswick and Saskatchewan, this is for kids who are under 16. Alberta, teachers and school staff no longer need parental consent to respect a student's pronouns and name, but they are still required to inform them. And you can imagine. I know that, you know, Danielle Smith said, we have child protection policies that, you know, are there to keep kids from being harmed by their parents. Well, it doesn't really help if the harm has already occurred. Or in some cases, I've started to also interview trans young adults, so 18 to like 25. That's a whole generation of very vulnerable trans kids. If they lose parental support, they can be homeless. Post-secondary education ideas go out the window. And certainly in Vancouver and other parts of Canada where rents are really high, losing family support is a huge threat to security and to the future. So I really think that these policies are going to be incredibly harmful. And certainly the students that I have talked to are just absolutely horrified, because for them, many of them, school has been the one safe place. So congratulations to all the educators in this room and online for creating that environment for some kids, because it means the world to them.
Jay, you talked about a child's agency. How does a policy like this requiring consent from parents if you're under 16 to be able to use your preferred pronouns, what impact does that have on a child's agency?
So I want to actually start by saying yes and to everything Travers
said. Sure, no, please go ahead.
Yes, and I'm really thinking about it from Saskatchewan, which is where I'm based.
Sure.
And so I'm going to talk about Bill 137, which is the number for the legislation in Saskatchewan. And I'm saying that intentionally because otherwise I have to call it the Parents' Rights Bill, which is a fiction. So the number, which is real, is how I'm going to talk about it. I hear from students about how this is creating a climate of fear at school. And I want us to think not just about the students who feel, if my parents know, I will be unsafe. It's important to think about them, but that's not all students. I want us to think about the students who feel that I'm worried about how my parents might respond, and I'm going to test this out at school first. This feels like a less emotionally dangerous place to try out my name, my pronouns, and I'm going to do it here first so that I can feel confident when I bring it home and talk about it with my parents. So these are not young people who are doing this in opposition to their parents. They're often feeling really based in love and respect, but they want space to feel sure first. And school's providing that space when there isn't legislation preventing it. I hear a lot from teachers who are feeling unsure about running GSAs now. What if I run a GSA and a student comes out to me in the GSA? Has my GSA, which I intended as a support, created a climate that is less safe for this young person? I hear a lot of principals saying, we're not going to do any of those programs anymore. And I hear a lot of teachers who are really angry because they feel the legislation is forcing them to violate the professional ethics for teachers, which really are to put the needs of children first and care for children. The most exciting piece in terms of youth agency is coming from young people in Saskatchewan who are organizing in protest. New year, new name is their slogan. So if we have to send home forms to parents every time someone changes their name and pronouns, what if we did it daily? Let us engage in malicious compliance. Let us bring our new names and our new pronouns in on a daily basis, go to the office and get paperwork. And how many of these do we need to have before the school says, this is not actually the business of education? This is the business of control. This is the business of domination, and we're not doing it anymore. So young people are organizing, they are exercising their agency, and they are putting to the test whether this is something that can be done.
Okay. And what about you, Victoria? I'll let you do a yes and then as well.
So I want to kind of pick up with what Travers was saying about, you know, the idea that home is kind of could become unsafe, right? And we know that there's a huge population of LGBTQ individuals who end up homeless, right? And this is historic. It's not something that's new. And so in particular, we know for trans communities, a lot of these individuals are lacking lots of resources. And so this idea that school becomes the space where you can play out these social things. And in particular, school is where we learn, how is society going to treat me? How am I going to be viewed and valued? And if we're telling them as youth, you're not going to be viewed and valued for your trans identity as a youth, what we're really telling them is that we don't want you to make it to adulthood. We don't want you to make it to adulthood with this identity. And so that's also going to increase less and less programs for trans adults, right? Because the conversation now is on them as youth, which is important, but they're going to grow up really quickly. And so if they know that they haven't had the social space in school, then they already know society is not looking out for them. And they don't have the protection of their parents once they hit 18. You know, that's my biggest fear, is that now we do have some parents who can speak for them, who can help them. But once they hit 18, who is going to be there, right? Because we haven't taught them that they were important. We haven't given them the resources that they can use to help them, because we've had to either lie about it or we've had to not be able to talk about it. So I definitely think it's important for us to think about how our trans youth are going to move forward if we're not building resources for them as youth and as adults. Mm.
I'd like to get to that, because you talked about the GSAs and how they are either being dismantled or not being started. So when you talk about resources and what that means. But first, we are talking about these policies in schools. What about for parents who may see these policies, who may see that New Brunswick and Saskatchewan say that, you know, if you don't feel comfortable speaking to your parent, we can direct you to an appropriate school staff who can help you come up with a plan. What do you say to parents who read that, who see that, and say, "That's I would like to be as engaged with my child's school life as much as possible. That seems reasonable to me." What do you say to those parents?
I speak to a lot of parents, actually, of trans kids and queer kids, and some of them talk about how they weren't the first person, they weren't the first place, home wasn't the first place. And others talk about being the only place where their kid could be themselves. You know, trans kids often live a double life. Some of them are authentic at school and hide at home because, you know, the message is loud and clear, I am not welcome here as I am. Or home is the only place where they can be seen for the boy or girl or non-binary kid that they are. And they talk about the difficulty of moving from one space to the other and how painful it is. And it's always about not being able to be trans in all those spaces. And some of the parents that I've spoken to whose kids took a while to share their transness with them, some of them were like really supportive, had queer and trans friends, but for whatever reason, their kid had looked on the internet and found that, you know, a lot of trans kids get kicked out of their homes when they come out. And even though their parents are incredibly supportive, they heard this misinformation, you know, like they heard this and they got frightened. But the parents, you know, talk about that as a little bit eye-opening. I thought I was creating a really safe and supportive space for my kid. And the fact that it was hard for them to tell me this is really important for me to know. And these parents have gone on to be incredible supporters of their trans kids. They've educated their families. They've gone into schools to educate staff, etc. So, you know, the parents that I've spoken with, the ones who didn't learn right away, they just feel lucky that their kid had the support that they did, that their kid is alive, that they can hug them, that they can feel optimistic about their future. They're grateful to the school.
And You said you look like you want to jump in there. Jay, go ahead.
I want to sort of take it from a teacher's perspective.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Because I hear from teachers who are really worried about parents who how might have complaints, who mm-hmm. might feel like they're not getting enough information. And one of the things that I found really valuable in helping parents and teachers navigate this is if we can recognize that both the teacher and the parent have the child's best interest as their guiding motivation, that common ground makes it easier to listen to each other. They may have different understandings about what's in the child's best interest, but a belief that both adults or both sets of adults are there to create a caring, nurturing environment for the child is a really helpful starting place for those conversations. I also would say, and I say this as a parent and as an educator, having children is a process of letting go.
I say that to myself all the time.
It's a process of letting go because you're making room for children to be their own people. I have worked with 4- and 5-year-olds in schools who have genders that their parents don't want them to have. And I've seen educators make room for those in brilliant, brilliant ways. And so I think about a kindergarten graduation and the teacher showing up for the photographs and the photographer saying, I've got roses for the girls and ties for the boys. And the teacher thinking, this is not going to work well, and spinning around to the class and saying, class, there's ties and roses. What's going to make you feel most fancy? That's the kind of thing that teachers are doing to create gender-inclusive classrooms. And so when a child comes home with a picture that doesn't look like the parents expected, the parents can come back and say, what happened? And the teacher can say, completely honestly, I gave the children the choice of what's going to make them feel most fancy. Because our job is to celebrate children and to help them feel safe. Creating an understanding that we're both working from the child's best interest helps those conversations happen and makes room to learn and listen to each other in it.
And is there a lack of that kind of understanding between parents? You're nodding at parents.
I'm nodding because I really think there is. Yeah. I think, first of all, I want to challenge who the parents are. And I think there's a perception that parents are heterosexual, that they're white, that they have a particular set of Christian values. And when we're thinking about the parents, that's the imagined parent community. I think a lot of educators feel really limited in what they can do because they're worried about the imagined parent community. And often that's the community because those parents are the loud voices mm-hmm. in a school community. They're not the only ones, but they are the loudest ones. And so we really need to recognize that our parent community includes queer and trans parents. It includes single parents. It includes a whole range of people. It includes multi-generational families. It includes all kinds of structures. And we need to think about how do we hear and make room for all of those families. Because making room for those families makes room for their kids.
Victoria, you talk about representation. How do we hear from those families?
So I definitely think, you know, research such as Travers and Jay, because a lot of the information that we see online is from the point of view of passion legislation or from the point of view of harm. But none of these people have actually talked to trans people, right? It's not like they're saying, well, I've done this research and I've talked to 50 trans people and they say that this is the policy. So I think it's also asking ourselves, why do we have legislation passing laws when the legislation in itself doesn't even represent us identity-wise, but where are they pulling their information from, right? Where are they getting information from? Where are they seeing the danger? Because if you talk to trans people, if you talk to trans kids, like I know today there was a walkout for trans youth, and it was organized by trans youth, right? The teachers didn't tell them this is what you do. So I think there's a lack of actual listening to trans youth. So I definitely think the research that Travers is doing, the research that Jay is doing, I'm doing, gives us more voices. And that's kind of part of my research is to historicize all of these trans voices so we don't hear things 50 years from now like, in my day, there were no trans people, or this is so different, right? And so I wish there was more talking to trans youth instead of telling them what they are either doing wrong or what's not right. I just wish somebody would say, tell me about you and what you want me to know. And then they will know that the things that we're teaching these children are not harming them,
because they're actually talking to them. And I think we don't have enough of actually talking to trans people for us to be making policies about trans people.
And given that it sounds like lack of information, where do you think the backlash and that rhetoric is coming from right now? And why is it happening right now?
I would say a lot of my research looks at the ways in which media pushes a particular type of trans person, or they push a particular type of narrative of look how much things have changed. So we may look at TV, we may see a lot of these people saying trans people are taking over, or there's so many more trans people now, but trans people are a very, very small part of the population, right? And so we have these repeated images of trans people that makes it seem like they're everywhere, and maybe there's this fear that they're taking over, much in the same way there was a fear that black people were taking over when we got one president. And so I think that people are no longer seeing, and by people I mean the dominant people may not see themselves as much, so then that maybe they're thinking that there's not a space for me, or if I give space to this individual, I lose space. So it seems like in some ways people are competing for the resource to be seen, when in reality there's space for everyone.
That fear, right? So where is the... how is the rhetoric or you know, these you talk about organized campaigns, how is that tapping into that fear?
Let me very briefly give a little history. The Christian right was behind anti-gay measures. If anybody remembers Anita Bryant, I'm scarred forever, I don't eat oranges, etc. And they started to fail. I know that in Canada in 2005, same-sex marriage was legalized, and that did create a cultural shift, for sure it did. But when anti-gay organizations and campaigns stopped being successful, they moved overseas. 2014, the anti-gay law that was passed in Sochi, Russia, it looked familiar to me. So I looked into it, and the person who provided the language for the anti-gay law in Russia was the same person who headed the Oregon Citizens Alliance in the 90s when I was a graduate student at the University of Oregon, and they had a measure put on the ballot that would make it illegal for anyone in a state-funded institution to mention homosexuality without condemning it, the so-called gay propaganda. It was the same person. And we've seen that these campaigns have been taken to various countries in Africa, other parts of the world, and they kind of perfected it. And then we see all of a sudden DeSantis in Florida, the Don't Say Gay, and we see, wow, okay. This is a global phenomenon that's, you know, associated with fascism and conservative gender politics. It's really, you know, very, very concerning. It's supported by oligarchic news empires. So this kind of information is really happening. And one of the things I think that we need to keep in mind is that the right is out organizing us. They're really good at it. They never lose. They understand that if they lose a campaign, they keep going. And it took 50 years to repeal Roe versus Wade. And the target is now on queer and trans people. And by using this focus on children, you know, and having people who really don't have other information going, what do you mean surgery on 7-year-olds? It's not happening. It's not happening. But, you know, you can say it and you can frighten people. And it's a deliberate tactic to stoke fear, just, you know, to push queer and trans people back out of public life, but also because of larger conservative social and economic agendas.
Jane?
Hi, welcome to the Saskatchewan political moment. Probably not a moment you spend a lot of time in. So here's the important thing you need to know. Currently, the government in Saskatchewan is made up of the Saskatchewan Party. Very creative name. There is a further right-wing party. The Saskatchewan Party is already to the right. There's a further right-wing party called the Saskatchewan United Party. We're going to call them the SUP. So the Sask Party and the SUP. So if you are the leader of the Saskatchewan Party and you have an election coming up next October, let's just say theoretically, because that's when it's scheduled, and you are worried about your voting base leaving your right-wing party for the further right-wing party with a strikingly similar name, One of the things you can do to show that you are really right-wing enough to keep their votes is to punish trans people for existing. And it's really important to pay attention to, it's not actually about the trans people, it is about satisfying the right-wing Christian votes. There is no compassion or care for the trans people in this moment, but it is very much, how do we protect the right-wing voter base? How do we signal to them we're on your side? In this, I'm talking as if I'm the Saskatchewan Party, which I'm not, but like, just bear with me for a moment. But I think it's really important we see this as what it is, which is a signaling we're going to pay attention to Christian values. And I'm going to circle back to agency for a moment. If you are a right-wing Christian, and particularly if you're a right-wing Christian man, you're probably white, and your power comes from being able to say, I know how this works. Men go out and make money. Women stay home and have babies. My children will dress the way they should, and they will have more babies, and then we'll take over the school board so that we can have what we want happening in schools happen in schools. That last part really is happening at about that speed. When you say, actually, people have agency and rights and ability to define themselves and put forward who they are in the world, you're challenging that entire structure of domination, which is why they are interested in saying not possible or making it not possible. I want us to get really comfortable with challenging right-wing Christian patriarchy, right? Because it makes more possibilities for more people, and to name it what it is.
I think it's also important because conservative parties are anti-immigrant, they're anti-indigenous, they're anti-women, etc. And by stoking fear among, say, new immigrant populations, for example, not only do they reinforce the racist notion that, you know, white people are progressive and, you know, people of color are conservative, which has no basis in reality, but they also obfuscate the fact that they actually are not going to represent the interests of those communities. And it's really important for people to understand that. Whereas, you know, I think in terms of the communities that I work in allyship with, they're far more diverse.
How then do you, politics is interwoven into all of this, but how do you, just keeping in mind what you said, you know, the parent and the teacher, I just want to bring it back to the school. I know we have a lot of educators in our audience. How do you cross the political spectrum? How does everybody just, you know, come to this table knowing that you have the child's best interest at heart and address those concerns wherever they may come from across that political spectrum?
So I'm thinking about the classroom and that immediate moment. And I want to say the teacher's job is to create safety in the classroom for all of the students. And so it is all of the students that they are respected, that they are safe, that they feel cared for. And I want us to pay attention to those words because they are not, and that my beliefs are enforced on everyone else. And that's a really important difference. So you can have beliefs I don't agree with, and I can still respect you and make safety for you in my classroom. And that's important. We are also trying to create spaces and classrooms that recognize whoever's in the room is going to engage in a more diverse world with more people and more possibilities than are present in that classroom right now. And how do we help them be ready to make friends, connections, relationships, have employment, with people who are different from all the people they've already met?
Victoria, that seems like something that exactly you've been thinking about, right? These are children who are going to grow up and go off into the world.
Yeah, right. And so it's important for us, you know, like Jay says, to really think about how we teach them safety, how we teach them to treat one another. Because we know that schools can be damaging, right? We know kids can be bullies. Sometimes teachers can be bullies. And so it's important for us to think through how are we teaching them how to treat other people as well as themselves. And especially if we're teaching that people who are trans or people who are LGBTQ or any type of difference is not welcome, then that also is traumatizing. There's so much psychological harm that trans people have to overcome. And so if we continue to push this narrative, we continue to pass these laws, we're also going to be dealing with a lot of psychological harm, a lot of trauma that's going to also interfere with how they can be in society. And so it's easy for people to say, well, trans people are maybe not contributing, or trans people are not working or being good citizens, but that's because you've traumatized them so much. How can they? Right? And it's so that if that's what people are so-called worried about, whether or not these particular individuals are going to function in society, they'll function much better without the psychological trauma that they're kind of taking in right now.
Just one last question. I know you want to address resources and tools for our audience as well. Is there anything you'd like to put forward that people can look up?
I'm going to point back at the ARC Foundation and the SOGI123 folks who have extensive materials available on their website. I'm going to point at the Public Health Agency of Canada, who has resources around gender diversity in schools and sexual diversity in schools in both French and English that are available for PDF downloads right away. I'm going to point out librarians, and I want to give particular credit to librarians who are doing incredible work to make 2S LGBTQ collections available to young people, which feels particularly important in this moment, again, in terms of where do you get access to information when home and school don't feel like places you can ask those questions or find those resources. So literally talk to your local librarians is a great move. Many teachers' unions across the country have resources. So whatever the teachers' union is where you are is a good place to look. And the reason that all of these professional organizations have resources is because this is, again, upholding professional ethics and the Human Rights Code. And I want to really resist the idea that this is radical work. Like, this is really basic work of respect and inclusion and celebration.
I would encourage people to look for resources that are supportive of trans kids, that tell the stories of trans kids. Because in my experience, I've been asked to, for example, sit on the EDI committee of the BC Soccer Association. I've talked to sporting organizations, and I've talked to school boards. I've talked to a lot of different groups. And when I tell stories about the kids that I've interviewed, it's a game changer. I think that, you know, as Jay said, if we were really thinking what is best for kids, and we asked kids who are gender nonconforming or trans, non-binary, what you would need, you would hear that SOGI education is really important, and you would hear about how incredibly great it is when people support you and believe in you and you can be yourself. And often they'll have stories of before versus after. And, you know, their parents are saying, you know, I was really worried, I was scared to death. And, you know, once they came out, they got so much support. It was amazing. I didn't expect it. And, you know, they're doing really, really, really well. So, you know, as Victoria emphasized, save them from trauma. You know, really right now, I think that the Alberta policy is saying better a dead trans kid than a living trans kid, because that kind of policy is, you know, I hate to do it. You know, I don't want to just talk about trans kids in terms of, you know, self-harm and violence against them and discrimination, because they're fabulous and they have so many exciting things to share with us. But this is just a reality that these kinds of policies will actually kill kids. And their parents are, you know, going to be devastated. So let's give them the support that they need so that they can support their kids.
Did you want to add to that?
As far as resources, I mean, I know people, especially now, try to stay out of politics. But please know who your politicians are. Please look at them, see what they are pushing, and really ask yourself, is this the person I want to re-vote for? Especially in local governments. Local governments have so much more power than people think. So who are the people who are making decisions about the Board of Education? Who are the people who are making decisions about what type of books are going to be in our libraries? So if you could just look up where you are, figure out who are those people, whether you've vote or not, just figure out who is the person that is making choices for you, and if you want that person or if you trust that person. Because we do have means to change it, but if we don't know who these people are, then we wake up one morning and then we have these bills passed and we're like, who is this Danielle Smith? I don't know. Let me look her up, right? And she's been there the entire time. So I think it's up to us to know who are the people who are making choices on our everyday lives.
Thank you very much. And we do have some questions now. And I will start with one question from online. I'm not hearing the misinformation regarding SOGI or parental rights. I'm hearing mostly personal stories and opinion. What is the misinformation that is out there, and what do you say to clear it up?
Well, let me touch on the misinformation about SOGI. You know, the accusation that SOGI is turning kids queer and trans. I don't know about any other adult in this room who has interacted with children, but trying to get them to be or do something that is not really who they are is incredibly difficult. Like, I just think about my daughter in her room, for example, you know, trying to get her to behave the way that I want to. There are always going to be queer and trans people. There have always been queer and trans people. The misinformation is that it is SOGI that is creating queer and trans kids. In reality, SOGI policies make school and society less hellish for queer and trans kids. So the decision is, how do you want queer and trans people of all ages to be treated? Not whether or not we can alter our institutional fabric to produce more or less of them.
How do you clear up what is the misinformation, and what do you say to clear it?
So I actually want to say that it's not my job to spread the misinformation. I don't want to give the misinformation airtime, so I want to actually give the facts airtime. I want to say things like, you can do work around sexual orientation and gender diversity with children of all ages. You can create inclusive, safe classrooms for children of all ages. And so I want us to think about these conversations in kindergarten. And the misinformation is what's happening. And what's actually happening is we're saying there's many ways to be a girl. There's many ways to be a boy. There's many ways to be both. There's many ways to be neither. You're going to figure out what's right for you, and we're going to follow your lead. That's the messaging. The messaging is things like, your body belongs to you, and you get to make choices about your body, except in moments of safety. So we're teaching people that they can say no to having other people touch them. We're teaching people that they need to check in before they touch someone else. That's, again, what's happening with young children. Again, we've talked a lot about how parents and teachers can work together. That's combating misinformation, because we're saying parents and teachers, both functioning from what is in the best interest of the child, working together is what's actually happening. We are saying that schools want to be safe places and want to also be hubs for families to come together. And again, I'm going to say this pushes back on the misinformation because it says what's really there. There's a lot of name-calling in the misinformation and a lot of fear-mongering. We've also said things like, surgery is not happening for young children, because it's not. And so some of the pushing back on misinformation, and I will say that I had to explain hormonal blockers to a group of people last night because Danielle Smith, who is not a medical doctor, does not understand hormonal blockers. And so her talking about hormonal blockers as permanent changes gives people incorrect information. So to be able to talk about hormonal blockers as putting puberty on pause, it's not actually making changes, it's preventing changes. And so I want us to think about a pause as not introducing something new, but as stopping something new from happening. And with blockers in particular, a technology that was created for children who are not trans, but who are experiencing precocious puberty, and that's why this is available, really, the idea that this is creating permanent changes is completely false. The misinformation is really circulating. The information and the facts, which I'm hearing across the panel, is the pushback. And I would also say that I think a lot of what we're hearing is research. It's not just stories, and it's not just personal opinions. These are experiences and understandings of broad groups. And part of what's happening right now is government saying, we don't need to consult. We don't need to talk to trans people, because, like, gosh, what might they say? Or if you're in Saskatchewan, the government's saying, we've consulted. And then the Freedom of Information saying, well, actually, we got 11 letters from parents. So that was our consultation. So I think it's also important to say the reason all of these professional organizations, the independent First Nations, all kinds of groups are saying these policies are dangerous, the ones that are harming trans kids, is because it's harmful. Like,
Alberta's a minister in Alberta was saying that they would go on into some consultation following Danielle Smith's announcement. Where do you see that going? Consultation with trans representatives and advocates.
So I would love a policy cycle where we begin with consultation rather than begin with policy. So if we started with consultation, and consultation that's about what do you need, what is going to support your life, that would be excellent. And what I really wanted to think about in terms of consultation is how are we making sure the people most impacted are the ones whose voices are being heard?
Victoria, any thoughts on misinformation?
Yeah. So I think as far as thinking about misinformation, one thing I can say is that a policy that a teacher has to tell a parent that their kid wants to change their pronouns, that's not going to stop them from being trans. So it's like, what is really the policy for? Because the policy's not going to stop trans kids from being trans. So there's this misinformation that if a parent knows that they could, in some ways, prevent their kid from being who they are, right? You may camp for a couple years, right? But they're going to do what all the other queer kids do. They're going to pack their bags. They're going to move to the big city. And so I think what's misinformation is that parents are losing their children. But what it really is you don't see your child. Your child was always there. But you think you're losing your child because they don't fit whatever dream you had when they were born. And I think all parents have to go through that, regardless if their kid is queer, regardless if their kid maybe wants to move away because they don't think America's the greatest country in the world, right? I think we all as parents have to deal with the fact that our kids are going to one day be adults. And no matter how hard we think it is, their process of changing and growing was always going to be that process. They were always going to be that person. And just because they learned this when they were 12 or 5, we know a lot of people transition when they're older. So teaching them at 5 doesn't matter. We teach these people at 20. People who learn at 20, they transition. So getting the information earlier or later is not changing anything. And so maybe they're afraid their kids can't handle it, but in reality, they can't handle it. So mm-hmm. I think the misinformation is that you guys can't handle this because your kids can. Kids can handle a lot more than we think they can. They usually can't handle it if they realize their parents can't handle it.
That is it for our questions. I know we have still so many coming in. Thank you for all of them. It sounds like you're gonna have to do another one of these, Travers. And I welcome back to the podium, Travers.
Thank you so much, Michelle. I wanna thank Victoria and Jay, as well as Michelle, for all their important contributions. Thank you again to SFU Public Square for making this event feel to us easy and fabulous. I know a lot of work goes behind that. But mostly what I want to do is thank each and every one of you, both in the room and online. Thank you for showing up for queer and trans youth today. And let me ask you to keep showing up for queer and trans youth because they really need you. Thank you.
And that was a panel discussion from SFU Public Square on sexual orientation and gender identity, known as SOGI. And I want to thank SFU Public Square for sharing that audio with us and enabling us to share it with you. Thanks for listening and stay tuned. Democracy Now! Is coming up.